A warning to our listeners. This episode contains strong language.
Previously, on Looking for the Tote Family.
He does know that he is being investigated. We have executed a search warrant.
A guy came out of the room, showed me his badge, and he said, I'm from the FBI.
Has he made any threats towards the children or the wife that you know of?
There's concerns.
Once that happened, I kind of knew that we were never going to see him again.
He's tapped out all his finance resources, and he has not contacted his family in over a week.
If it has something to do with what he saw as a young man in that house.
He was awakened because he heard the shot, and he walks into his mother's bedroom, and he sees her bleeding profusely with her head on the pillow.
If Tony hadn't gone through that trauma as a child, do you think that Megan and your grandkids would still be alive?
Yes.
From the day in New London, Connecticut, I'm Taylor Hartz.
And I'm Sten Spinella.
And this is Looking for the Tote Family.
Anthony has cooperated with the investigation and he has confessed to killing his wife, Megan, and their three children.
Through all the twists and turns we've navigated in this case, the typical whodunit question has seemed pretty straightforward. According to police, Tony Tote confessed to killing his wife and children. So we focus our investigation on trying to answer the whys and the hows. How did this perfect family wind up murdered? Why were they killed? We always thought we knew the answer to the question of who, until we finally got to hear from Tony. Sten and I had been writing the name Tony Tote over and over for months, interviewing family members and friends and colleagues about this man we'd never even met, digging into all the personal details of his family and his business and his life, even though we'd never even spoken to him or even heard his voice. Besides knowing that he allegedly confessed to police, we'd never been able to hear his side of the story. Then, in May of 2020, I received an email from the state's attorney's office in Osceola County. Attached was an audio file.
This call will be recorded and subject to monitoring at any time.
It was a recording of a phone call Tony made from jail to his sister Chrissy on February 27th, 2020.
Thank you for using IC Solutions.
I downloaded the file and pressed play.
Hello, Tony.
Hey.
And these were the first words I heard Tony Tote say.
What's up, G-Stuff?
It's good to hear your voice.
After waiting to hear from this man for months, I couldn't believe that the first words I heard from him were, "What's up, cheese puff?" I must have rewound the recording 10 times.
I've been held in isolation. I still am. I'm making this phone call under direction and supervision.
No, I get it.
No, it's beyond what I can explain right now.
Taylor and I both felt it was surreal to finally hear Tony's voice. Even though we spent all this time researching and writing and talking about this man, I didn't really think about the fact that I'd never heard him speak before until I heard him in this phone call.
I don't remember anything pretty much over Christmas and the first week I got here. I don't remember coming here.
We were hoping for some explanation, however vague, of what happened the day of the murders. Instead, we listened as Tony said he doesn't remember anything between Christmas Day and going to jail.
I don't remember anything. After the events, what happened, all that kind of stuff, I have no idea where I was, where I am, and the only thing I remember is being at the hospital, I guess before I got here, and I remember the talk about charcoal, fifth floor, and catheter, and that's all I remember, and I remember waking up here and seeing one of the officers that I've become pretty close with. Other than that, I have no idea anything.
More than a year later, we still don't know the exact date that the murders took place, and we may never know. So we can't discern whether Tony is claiming to have lost his memory before or after the murders. What we do know is that Tony allegedly lived in the house with his family's bodies for at least 2 weeks, and his statements throughout this call are quite contradictory. He starts off by telling his sister that he doesn't remember anything, but then goes on to describe things from the same time period in a great amount of detail. And those details he does remember give him an alibi for the night his family was killed.
The night everything happened, okay, I'm going to tell you this. I went over because Zoe wanted her Mickey silver necklace for reasons you'll find out later, okay?
Yeah.
Megan had said it was in the her jewelry box that's hanging on the back of the door of the master bedroom.
Okay. In the condo.
In the condo.
Okay.
I went there after we ate dinner. Kind of grossed out because my son ate the leftovers of the meal that was, it was a seafood dinner that they mistakenly gave to me instead of the chicken dinner. So he was eating tentacles and other puke, you know what I mean? That's valid for you. But anyways, I went over to the condo to get that. That was the one last thing we needed. I spent about 2 hours over there trying to find the key. We couldn't find the key. So at about 7:30, 8 o'clock, I walked back to the garage and got the crowbar, went back to the condo and opened it up, okay? I left it open because I figured you were out and you would have come down later and take care of it. But I couldn't find the Mickey thing. So if you could find that, but couldn't find it in the jewelry box, I ended up falling asleep. And let's just leave it at that, okay? I fell asleep for, I was supposed to wake up at 11:30, didn't wake up till the next morning. So if you can find that, just keep it safe.
I will.
Tony was hell-bent on finding a Mickey Mouse necklace that he said he failed to find on the night of the murders. For someone who had said they remembered nothing for an extended period of time, Tony goes into great detail about his search for this necklace. It's confusing to say the least. The medical examiner in Florida told us the family had been dead for about 2.5 weeks, which would put the deaths after Christmas. But Tony says he doesn't remember Christmas. It's possible he got his stories crossed about his amnesia. It's possible the night of the murders happened on a different date than the official narrative. And it's possible Tony actually doesn't remember this period of time because of the shock and trauma of the crimes. Tony also says that he left the condo open because he thought Chrissy or Megan's aunt Cindy would come down later and take care of it. This stray comment brought up a lot of important questions. Why does Tony sound like he's planning for something with some sense of finality? What does it mean that he'd leave the condo open? That suggests to me that Tony was not going to be around to take care of things. We don't know what his true aim was, but at the very least, it sounded like he was planning on not being there to take care of the condo.
For all the things he does seem to remember, he says that he has no recollection of his alleged confession to police.
No idea what I told investigators because I was completely stoked. I have no idea. I just know that I'll protect Megan's secrecy if I'm there again.
Tony allegedly confessed while he was at the hospital, where he was taken for a suspected Benadryl overdose. Investigators said that he was unstable and seemed out of it when he was taken there, and Tony seems to say the same thing about his state of mind at that point. But he says he knows he would have protected his wife until the end.
I do wish that you would have talked to me a little bit more, though. And I get it, and we, you know, don't get into it, but I do, I love you.
I was asleep, so I wake up the next morning, so, because of diabetes and everything. But, well, just so you know, good city to love on, go make her.
It's hard to understand everything that Tony says here. But it sounds like he says that he fell asleep and didn't wake up until the next morning, and that changed everything. He says something about loving, honoring, and obeying Megan, which is something he says again later on.
I want you to know a couple of things. That, you cared, Nick. And I absolutely loved, honored, and obeyed Megan through everything. Um, his last name will come out. You should talk about him right now.
He's a bit cryptic and says things like, I can't talk about that right now, and for reasons that you'll find out later. Presumably because he knows he's on a recorded line and has been advised not to talk about the case.
Realize that, okay?
I know, and I'm holding on to that, which is why so much of this doesn't make sense. But, you know, Tony, I'm here for you. I am, and I will be with you, Mom, Kelly, Lee. We're all here. Obviously, we're all at different stages of, you know, grieving. But we're here for you. We are.
Taylor and I essentially eavesdropped on Tony's conversations with his sister. And as mundane as it was in some parts, it was extraordinary to hear the two people we've wanted to interview most during this project speak with each other.
Is Mom okay?
Okay. You're not
seriously. Hold on. Give me a sec to think about it. She's okay. I mean, obviously, she's very upset. She's reliving a lot.
Chrissy says that their mother is sort of reliving her past with her family once again plastered across the front page of the local news. In 1980, Loretta was the subject of another grisly crime when her husband, Tony's father, was convicted of hiring someone to kill her. Now she's seeing her son's name in the headlines, accused of killing her daughter-in-law and grandchildren.
And the media sucks and people are suck. But she's okay. She's strong, and you know that she's strong. So she will make it through. She'll be fine.
Tell her I love her voice.
I will.
The conversation with Chrissy lasts about 15 minutes, and Tony spends a good portion of the call talking about logistics.
Listen, my car is at Executive LA.
His bank accounts, where his car is parked.
The car is in great condition. It might need new batteries, definitely needs new tires, but the car is in phenomenal condition.
How the Mickey Mouse key unlocks the condo and the Yoda key unlocks the office.
Yoda is the office key. Mickey is the house key.
Okay.
I got baseball cards and that kind of stuff up in the office.
He tells her where his rare baseball cards are and to make sure she gets them.
In my car, there's a bunch of rare baseball cards that Tim should have or Ella should have. I'll save them for the kids' college education.
And where are the cards at?
Those specific ones are in a blue Tupperware container in the back of my car.
I used to collect baseball cards, and I found it weird that when Tony told his sister where his rare ones were, I don't know anyone who regularly keeps their rare baseball cards in the back of their car. This baseball card comment is similar to his comment about leaving the condo open for relatives to take care of it. Both details, disclosed kind of matter-of-factly, indicate that Tony was planning on going away. It was also odd, you know, that the information about where his valuables were was on the tip of what sounded like now Tony's sharp memory.
Mac is at my Mac desktop in my physical therapy office.
Mm-hmm.
Has all pictures.
Okay.
All the pictures up until maybe a year or two ago.
Okay.
Every single picture I've ever taken.
The conversation sounds like someone talking to their sister who's taking care of their house or walking their dog while they're on vacation. This is where my car is parked. This is where the key is. It doesn't sound like a man who is talking to his sister for the first time after his entire family was, as he alleges, murdered by someone else.
I got Mom, her dad's ring back.
You got it?
I haven't found it yet. I haven't gone down there yet. I go down there Monday.
Tony and Chrissy also talk about a few pieces of jewelry that Chrissy is trying to track down while she's in Florida. She asks Tony where their grandfather's ring is, and he tells her that he was wearing the ring around his neck, along with a cross, when he was arrested.
Okay, the condo. It was on my possession. I remember putting it on my crucifix around my neck.
Oh, I was thinking of the wall crucifix. Okay. It's on a necklace.
On my neck, yes, because in my wedding...
So wait a minute. Wait. On the necklace that you were wearing...
Yeah, I was wearing a necklace. I wore a necklace.
Okay, so the police, the police or the jail might have, because I asked about yours and Megan's wedding rings.
Chrissy asked her brother where his wedding ring is, and he tells her that Megan had been wearing his ring on her thumb.
Megan's wedding rings got stolen a couple of years ago by the babysitter. Can't prove it, but...
Okay, but she had wedding. She had rings on her.
She had my wedding ring on her thumb.
Okay. Okay.
On her left thumb.
So then I need to, okay, so I will figure out, I don't know who has your necklace then.
This detail stood out to me because it meant that every single member of the Tote family was wearing some type of jewelry when the murders took place, except Zoe. We know from the autopsy reports that the boys were both wearing rosary beads around their necks when they died, which seems linked to the importance of the necklace Tony was searching for Zoe. In this call, Tony tells Chrissy that he was at their condo searching for Zoe's Mickey Mouse necklace the night his family died. He said it was the last thing they needed, for reasons his sister would find out later. That statement has always stuck with me. It's kind of haunted me. Why would it be a last thing for Zoe to have that necklace? Are these details the indication of some sort of ritual? Or proof that they all knew that something bad, something final, was going to happen that night?
I don't know. I put that on and it's a tight takeoff. So I didn't.
All right.
I had it on me the whole time. There's a few things I do remember. And I remember always checking to make sure it was there. It was always strapped around my crucifix.
After we got those phone calls in April, I figured there must be more. So in September, I filed a public records request with the state's attorney's office in Osceola County, requesting recordings of all phone calls Tony had made or received while he was in jail. They gave us three recordings to start with, of calls made in February, March, and April.
Hello, you have a call from...
Tony, who?
An inmate at Osceola County Corrections Department.
The first call is dated February 5th, 2020, and it's only 1 minute long.
To accept this call, press or say 5.
It seems like it's the very first time Tony and Chrissy spoke since his arrest.
Hello?
Hi.
Hi.
How are you?
How am I? How are you?
I'm okay.
Huh?
Okay.
I'm worried about you.
I know.
Are you okay? I mean, it's a stupid question to ask. I don't even really know what to say.
I know. Sorry.
I wish I knew. I wish I could have helped.
I couldn't get help, so.
You what?
I couldn't even help.
I know, hon, but.
Not enough.
I'm really glad that you called, though. I've been really worried about you.
Please stand by to be connected to the customer service center.
In the first phone call, a short one, we hear a sort of despondent Tony. He sounds quieter, less assertive and self-assured than he does in later phone calls to his sister.
Hello.
Hey.
Cheese Puff, what's up?
How are you?
Pretty good. What are you up to?
We are running all around dealing with your shit.
The subtext of the phone calls was compelling to me. You can sometimes hear Chrissy hint at the heinous crimes, which Tony denies but apologizes for because he said he didn't stop them. You can also hear Tony try and cajole Chrissy, convince her he's innocent, and show that he's still her brother. The small talk can get tiresome, but you hear the siblings grasping for a normal conversation or an exchange they may have had before everything changed.
Now you got me laughing.
Well, we'll see how quickly I can do it now, you know, instead of listening to everyone.
When the topic of their father, Robert Tote, comes up, the siblings commiserate over their shared bitterness toward him.
Have you heard from Bob?
Don't even fucking get me started.
Yeah, well, you know.
Is he harassing you?
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Sorry.
And, you know, there's really no way to talk to you about it anymore unless you call, so...
I'll call as much as I can. And it's okay to talk about because I need to process it myself.
I reached out to him to see if he had heard from you because I couldn't get a hold of you, and it just kind of started...
His article.
And it just started it all over again, and it's just...
Yep, and, you know, 80% of one of the articles... that was written was all about him remaining. And his quotes and all that.
So,
a lot of their discussion of Robert was how he had been in the news recently in an article that sounds like the Hartford Current article we discussed in episode 5. Chrissy also tells Tony that Robert is using the media attention on Tony's crimes to push claims of his own innocence.
Oh, there's a minute left. It just came on. So just so you know, that is the only article that I have done, and the only reason I did it is because he's using you as a platform to once again profess his innocence, and that just pissed me off. And the fact that he's, you know, putting mom, it's like mom's going through it all over again. And, you know, he's using that as a stepping stool to once again say, you know, that basically mom was wrong.
In a call dated March 3rd, Chrissy is down in Florida taking care of some of Tony's affairs. She says she found Zoe's necklace, the necklace he was so concerned about retrieving in one of the earlier calls.
I found Zoe's necklace.
You found what?
I found Zoe's necklace.
Where was it?
It was in the jewelry box.
Oh, my God. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you for using IC Solutions. Goodbye.
Chrissy says that she finally found Zoe's Mickey Mouse necklace, the one that Tony says he was searching for at their condo the night that his family was killed. When Tony hears this, he gets emotional. He sounds so relieved, yet sad that this necklace he was searching for, this necklace that he says kept him away from his family that night, has finally been found.
Though he doesn't exactly come out and say it in these phone calls, Tony attempts to blame Megan, one of the victims, for the murders. It's important to say that we cannot confirm what Tony is saying here, but we're trying to get at the truth. And for that reason, it's worth hearing his side of the story. Tony talks at length about how Megan was controlling. In the March and April phone calls released to the day in October, Tony suggests that Megan kept him from asking extended family for help in general. That she kept him from telling anyone about the family's troubled financial situation, and that she kept him from seeing a doctor for his health issues. One day in 2019, when Tony was alone at the house with Zoe, he said he passed out while they were watching a movie because of a variety of health problems. When Megan came home, he pleaded with her to let him go to the doctor.
One day in August, Meg went out with the kids, went out with the boys, food, whether it be a farmer's market or the store or something, and Zoe and I were, you know, we wanted to, she put her cowboy boots on, we're watching Aladdin and her cowgirl boots and whatnot. And next thing I know, Megan's shaking me. I was passed out with my head on the sectional. I was on the floor behind the table. And I guess Zoe had been screaming because I hadn't been able to wake up. I looked at her and I'm like, can I go to the doctor now? Like, you're trying all these things here. I said, I need to find out what's going on.
This anecdote is one of several examples Tony cites about how controlling Megan is. The story also conveniently depicts Megan as the cause of one of the family members' physical pain. And with young Zoe alone while Tony was passed out, Tony is also placing the blame on Megan for putting one of their children in danger.
So I've been doing some counseling here.
Okay.
I just want to say I'm sorry for anything I've done to upset you.
At one point, Tony does apologize to Chrissy for anything he'd done to upset her.
You know, life is very fragile, and it's very, yeah. So, in case, whatever, yeah, I want you to know.
Chrissy is sort of vague in response, but she says that if the family was in a bad way, he could have talked to her or other relatives. But Tony said he wasn't allowed to do that.
We love you. We're just so confused at all of this. And we don't get into it. But it's just, you know, that we would have done anything for you. And that's the part that just hurts. That we want to help you. We wanted to help you in any way that we could have.
I wasn't allowed to. The whole aspect of, you know, I'm sorry I was forced to move away from you guys. That was all her. She had a really limited, and she didn't want anybody knowing anything about what was going on.
But Tony, it's still like, I just, it's just, I don't know, it just, I just wish, I don't know, I don't even know how to say it, but I wish, and again, everything's hindsight, like I just wish you would have talked to us, whether you were allowed to or not, but I just wish you would have talked to us. And
I know that. I know. I've been through the counseling.
Tony mentioned someone named Mendoza, who he's working with while in jail. According to court documents, a woman named Daisy Mendoza is a mental health professional at the jail.
Sorry. I really appreciate you doing this. I really appreciate you always being there for me. And I know you've always been there for me. It's just, how I got in the way.
Yeah, it's not that it got in the way, Tony, because it never should get in the way. I mean, family is not just your immediate family. It's us, too. It's, you know, it's Cindy, it's Stu, it's all of us.
At one point, Tony asks about Cindy and Stuart, Megan's aunt and uncle. Chrissy sort of shuts him down. She says her side and Megan's side of the family are working through their grief together.
Are Cindy and Stu okay?
Well, I say this with love, but it's a stupid question to ask. You know what I mean? Like, they're... She's getting through it, you know, but it's just, this hasn't been easy on any of us, you know.
I know.
Trying to, you know, just understand, like, because that's the thing is, like, they said the same. They wanted to help. If they knew anything, they wanted to help. Thankfully, Tony, we're all still together on this, and we're committed to being together because we are family. Like, Cindy and Stu, they are our family. Mary Lou and Larry, they are our family. Like, we're all grieving and we're all trying to get through this together.
Yeah. Well, realize that wasn't there. And I couldn't. I didn't stop this because I wasn't there.
I know. And I get what you're saying. I'm just saying, this is us.
Attempts, just so you know.
Huh?
Multiple attempts in the last... there's been over a time frame. There's been attempts. So, which is why at this time I was stuck down here trying to handle things. To say them.
We don't know for sure what Tony is referring to here, but he says that there have been multiple attempts in the past and that he had to stay in Florida after Thanksgiving to try to stop those attempts. He doesn't outright accuse his wife of the murders in these calls or of trying to kill their children before, but it sounds like he's implying these accusations.
In episode 1, you heard from Megan's aunt and uncle, Cindy and Stuart, who told us about how they had been receiving a bunch of really confusing text messages from Megan and Tony in the month of December. They told us they got texts that said the family was sick with the flu, that they were going on vacation, that Megan had lost her phone, and that they were going off the grid. At some point, they started to think that all the communication was coming from Tony, pretending to be Megan. And then all the communication stopped. But because we haven't been able to speak to Chrissy about this, we didn't really know what the rest of the family's communication was like with them during that time period, until this phone call.
Do you remember talking to us?
When?
In December?
No. Did I talk to you guys?
Well, you don't remember some of the...
What's that?
Stuff you said?
I have no idea what you're talking about, Chrissy.
No, you're kind of an ass, so...
I'm so sorry. I'm sorry. Oh, my God. Please, just feel it. Okay?
It is what it is, but it's just... Like I said, we've always been able to kind of, like, argue and get over it, you know what I mean? Like, I call you an ass, and, you know, the fact that I'm dealing with your shit, you know, but...
When did we talk?
Well, we didn't talk. We were texting.
We were?
Because you wouldn't talk to me. You don't remember talking to Lee or Kelly?
No.
Did you know we were looking for you? It's all right. No, it's okay. It's all right. I mean, it's okay.
When the Looking for the Tote Family Facebook group was first posted, a lot of people were commenting, berating Tony's sisters for not checking in on their family sooner. But this conversation gives us an indication that maybe they were fighting. Maybe Tony hadn't been very nice to them, and Chrissy and the rest of their family weren't surprised that they hadn't heard from him in a couple of days. In this call, Chrissy doesn't seem like she's still upset with Tony about those conversations or the things that he may have said, but more like she wanted to understand her brother's state of mind and whether he even remembered those interactions.
Listen. We love you. Okay? And that's the thing that you just gotta, I don't know, you gotta remember that we do. We love you very much.
I know. We're talking to you. I'm so sorry.
But just listen. It's, you know, how often are you able to call? Because, like, I was surprised you were calling today.
I blew up at a few people. And okay. I've gotten phone privileges, so I'm not quite sure how often I can call. But I was able to call here.
Because, okay.
My sister's down. I need to talk to her.
I've been keep checking, like, for visitation, and you're still not eligible or...
They have me on security aspect, and I have a funny feeling. I got yelled at by Mendoza yesterday, not in a bad way. But I have this innate ability, and it's really coming out, to protect Megan.
Okay.
And for people who don't know what's going on or anything, they would not know anything Megan was doing.
Yeah, well, that's not, you know, it's not a hashtag.
No, but that's, and she yelled at me for that, and I was like, okay.
I'm just telling you, that's something I could have told you. You've always been a pleaser. You've always been whatever,
I know.
Yeah,
that's exactly what she told me. And I'm realizing it. I'm really, I'm like, holy shit. Yeah, the amount of control she had, which brings it to another aspect.
Tony said that Mendoza, who we assume is his counselor, pointed out that he's trying to protect Megan. Protect her from what? We don't know. But his sister said that she wasn't surprised to hear that, and tells her brother that he's always been a people pleaser. Chrissy again advises her brother not to hash out too many details while he's on a recorded line, but Tony goes on to say that his wife had a lot of control over him. This isn't the first time we've heard him say that. He mentioned her control in his account of his health issues, when he said he had to ask his wife permission to visit a doctor, and again when he told his sister that he wasn't allowed to ask his family for help or to tell anyone about the problems they were having.
In these calls between brother and sister, we were offered brief glimpses into the other side of the story, the side of the accused. We hear Tony's account of the night his family was killed, and his narrative that he was asleep and had nothing to do with the murders. We hear insinuations that his wife, Megan, wasn't the innocent person everyone thought she was. He says she was controlling, and maybe even homicidal. Though it's difficult to hear Tony blame his dead wife, whom we'd heard was a sweet woman, even a ray of sunshine, we've been starved for details other than the sheriff's office's limited account of the murders. Are Tony's accusations further proof of his capacity for lying? Is there some truth in his description of Megan? How do we discern the truth between the possibility that Tony is not guilty of these crimes and the possibility that he's opportunistically lying? It seems suspect that he doesn't remember anything at all between Christmas and the beginning of 2020. Is his poor memory a result of trauma, or is it convenience? We also hear Tony's account of what life has been like in jail, how the corrections officers like him, and tell him that he should write a book about his experiences when he gets out.
I get COs that come by a different one each day. There's one guy who consistently comes by every other day, and he tells him the news, and we talk, and they're really good to me here, and it's the corporals and the the two stripes and the three stripes, they'll come by and just be like, when you get out of here, you gotta write a book. When you get home, you gotta write a book. You gotta write a book about this place. Nobody, I'm like, yeah, I don't know. It's just a different thing to happen. So.
I don't need any books written.
What?
You don't need any books written.
Chrissy quickly shoots down that idea. But in our next episode, we do hear from Tony more in depth. It's not a book, but it may as well be. He penned a 27-page letter to his father about the night of the killings and the nights leading up to them.
Megan, the kids were everything to me, you know.
No.
I'm still madly in love with her. I'm still madly in love with the kids, you know. But
if you or someone you know is in crisis, help is available. Call Mental Health America's crisis hotline at 1-800-273-TALK. If you haven't already, please subscribe to Looking for the Tote Family on your favorite podcast app. And don't forget to rate the show. Find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Looking for the Tote Family is hosted and reported by Taylor Hartz and Sten Spinella. Produced by Peter Huapi and Carlos Virgen. Written by Taylor Hartz, Sten Spinella, and Peter Huapi. Editing by Peter Huapi and music by Carlos Virgen. Tim Cotter is our executive editor. And Izaskun Larnieta is our managing editor. Social media management by interns Josette Moses and Allison O'Donnell. This has been a production of The Day in New London, Connecticut.